and welcome back to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and today I'm speaking with Mario T. Garcia, author of The Chicano Generation, Testimonials of the Movement, published by the University of California Press in 2015. Dr. Garcia is a professor of Chicano Studies and History at the University of California, Santa Barbara, where his research and teaching focus on U.S.-Mexico migration and Chicano and Latino community formation, identity, and politics. Professor Garcia has a distinguished and prolific list of publications, including the highly influential Mexican Americans, Leadership, Ideology, and Identity, as well as Memories of Chicano History, The Life and Narrative of Bert Corona, and more recently, Blowout, Sal Castro, and the Struggle for Educational Justice, and the Latino Generation, Voices of the New America. Dr. Garcia has been honored with a number of awards, fellowships, and distinctions for his scholarship, including the two-times recipient of the Southwest Book Award for his publications Desert Immigrants, The Mexicans of El Paso, and the previously mentioned Mexican Americans. Hello, Mario, and welcome to New Books in Latino Studies.
Thank you, David, so much. Thank you for having me on the program. I look forward to our discussion.
Me too. Thank you. And I was wondering, will you begin our discussion today by telling us a little bit about your personal background and your academic and professional trajectory?
Well, I was born in El Paso, Texas, and grew up there. My father was an immigrant from Mexico. He was ran a used furniture store in South El Paso for many years. My mother was a U.S.-born Mexican-American, had a high school education. And we were raised not in the hardcore barrio of South El Paso, but in transitional neighborhoods, literally north of the tracks. And my mother insisted that we go to Catholic school, so I went to elementary Catholic schools and Catholic boys' school in El Paso. And I had wanted to go to a Catholic college, but didn't have the funding for it, so I stayed locally and went to what is now the University of Texas, El Paso, where I got my BA and MA in history. And then after about a year, I came to California. I was actually recruited as a lecturer in history at San Jose State University in the late 60s. And then from there, matriculated down to UC San Diego, where I did my PhD in the next 5 years, and then was recruited here to UC Santa Barbara. In between, I taught 3 years at Yale, and but I've been in UC Santa Barbara for many years. And when I was a graduate student, I was already affected by the Chicano movement, so I wanted to do a dissertation on Chicano history, and eventually focused on the history of early Mexican immigrants in El Paso in the late 19th, early 20th century, the first big wave of mass immigration, which what I refer to now as the immigrant generation in Chicano history, and focused on my own hometown of El Paso, which I didn't know a lot about other than what I heard through family lore. And I discovered, of course, that it was the major entryway at that time for most Mexican immigrants, because they transferred up from central Mexico and northern Mexico by the Mexican Central Railroad. So I did that as a dissertation, revised it. That became my first book, which you mentioned, Desert Immigrants. And then I've kind of gone up through the 20th century, because I never felt that, unlike other historians, that I felt that I had the luxury of specializing in a particular period, because we still knew so little about many different other periods in Chicano history. I felt I didn't have that luxury, so I said, well, I'm going to move up, and I'm going to study the children of those immigrants, and that let me just study the Mexican-American generation, the 30s through the 50s, and I've done several studies there. And then I went to study my own generation, the Chicano generation, because I was, in a sense, a product, an intellectual product of the Chicano movement, and part of the first generation of professionally trained Chicano historians into the 70s, so I embarked on my study of the Chicano movement. You mentioned the Sal Castro book, and the book we'll discuss today, the Chicano generation. So, and then, you know, I kind of leapfrogged and studied my own millennial students in the book that you also mentioned, called The Latino Generation, Voices of the New America. So using a generational approach that I began to develop over the years, pretty much have spanned the 20th century and now have leaped into the new millennium.
Right. You mentioned the generational approach, and that's one of the primary themes that this book and I think your writings fall under. There's the generational approach or model that you've identified, and that's been, you know, again, a key theme throughout your scholarship. And there's also the focus on leadership. Will you explain for our audience the generational model that you've identified and applied to your scholarship, and then you know, the role of leadership within, you know, that model?
Okay. Well, I began to conceptualize generations as a way of understanding periodization in Chicano history. In other words, what were the important historical periods that we can focus on for their own particular characteristics. And after I had done my book on immigrants in El Paso and began to kind of, as I mentioned, conceptualize that as the immigrant generation in Chicano history, because, as I have to explain to people, because obviously we have continuous immigration for the most part through the 20th century and still do, but the difference is that immigrant generation in the early 20th century thoroughly dominated, with exceptions like northern New Mexico, the Mexican presence in the United States. Immigrants came, they overwhelmed the 19th century, Californios and Tejanos and other Mexican-Americans who were already here in the 19th century, and they became the dominant population. And no other later period in American in Chicano history do immigrants play such a dominant role. The L.A. coast from a 19th century Mexican to Mexican immigrant community. Beyond that period of the early 20th century, of course, immigrants remain a very large numbers, but they now have to coexist with U.S.-born Mexican-Americans. Mm. By 1940, the majority of Mexicans in the United States are now U.S.-born, and that continues up to our own day. There's still sizable numbers of immigrants, but right, they're not the minority population. So in conceptualizing that period as a period of immigrant generation, well, then I began to, you know, examine, well, what other generations, and when I use the term generation, it's not just biological, but also as political and historical generations,
right,
although they do tend to coincide with biological generations, but they are transitional figures that don't necessarily fit comfortably into their political generation. You mentioned Sal Castro, biologically, really is part of the Mexican-American generation, but politically and historically, he's part of the Chicano generation.
Mm-hmm.
So I needed a way of periodizing, of understanding different periods in Chicano history where you see particular differences and evolutions of identity. So a generational approach gave me that perspective of the early 20th century. You have predominantly immigrant population. In the 30s and 30s and 50s, you have now the rise of a U.S.-born Mexican-American generation, the so-called Mexican-American generation. Of course, then you have a whole new wave of political activists in the 60s and 70s. How do we understand them? Well, you know, we understand them as part of a new generation, a Chicano generation. I think, too, David, the other reason I chose a generational approach is that by doing so, it gives me a sense of social change. It gives me a sense of political change, how change takes place and how you see that change between different generations. So that's something that I focused on. The issue of leadership, of course, has come out of that, because in studying generations, and especially studying political generations, like they did in my Mexican-American book, which is not a study of the biological Mexican-American generation, but the study of new leadership.
Right.
The same thing with my Chicano generation book. You know, it's a study of leaders who emerge out of that generation. And so I focused on the role of leadership within these generational cohorts. And I find that important because all political, social movements, need leadership. Leadership emerges, and it's not from an elitist point of view, but it's the fact of these movements, of social political movements, that some people rise to the challenge and emerge as key leaders. And so those leaders are also a window to look at social change and generational change. And so I emphasize the important role of leadership in Chicano history. And by doing so, you know what, it's also important because for our students, for our communities, it's important point that we know that we've had leaders, that we've had important leaders. And
right.
It's those leaders that emerge in the movement that people are more aware of, like Jesus Chavez, but going back in time, we've had a number of major political and community leaders that people need to know. Our kids need to know. Our students need to know them. Who are they? Because that gives them a sense, as Sal Castro often used to say, a sense of pride that they are part of history. They are part of American history.
Right.
Because they've had leaders who have been part making important changes in this country.
I think that's a great point. You know, the focus on leadership in telling a narrative, particularly in our in the way education, you know, just is taught and kind of proceeds in the United States, K through 12 education, it the connecting leaders to a portion of American history, that allows you to plug them into a spot to some extent, does provide, I think, a very necessary type of, first of all, coherency, but like you said, a source of identification, right, for people of various ethnic backgrounds to be able to see themselves and their people as actors in, this historical narrative, if you will.
Yeah.
And there's obviously historians talk about a lot of the problems with, how we define narratives and stuff like that. But it is nonetheless a truism that, this is kind of the way that history is told, predominantly, particularly in K through 12 and even, higher education, this focus on chronologies, on, key peoples, key, ideas, events, et cetera. And I agree. And I appreciate your approach, because it seems to me, you mentioned earlier, as you were, a rising scholar, an emerging scholar, you didn't have the luxury of, say, the generation that I'm a part of, right, where we have experienced some, 30, 40 years of Chicano scholarship, rather recent Chicano scholarship, right? And where we are able to now, I'm speaking of my generation, say, of the scholars, are able to benefit from a generational perspective like that which you have provided as a starting point, right, as a basis, right? Whereas, studies since books like yours and those of your generation have delved into a lot of other particularities within these generations. So they're not so much, I think, as you've started to imply, they're not so much very rigid categories, but they do provide coherency. They do provide direction that allow us to see the development of, right, ideas that don't emerge from whole cloth, but are dependent upon, right, previous people, previous ideas, et cetera, but are transitioning, right, from...
Well, the other thing that I try to emphasize is that people make history.
Mm-hmm.
Don't make history as individuals, but they're as part of broader social struggles and social movements.
Mm-hmm.
But it is important to get a sense of that people make history. So if people make history, you can make history.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's a great point. One other thing I wanted to bring up about the generational model, because it has been highly influential. I was recently speaking about a month or two ago with Carlos Blanton about his recent biography of George Sanchez. And, in his book, he mentions how influential your model has been. And essentially it's stood the test of time, so to speak. There hasn't been a more convincing or useful model that has been presented and has stuck. So one thing that I've wondered about the model is, and we've started to talk about this, or the distinctions between generations, how they're not, they are kind of more guideposts, I think, and this is my interpretation, you can correct me, they seem to be more guideposts, not essentially fixed in time, because as you mentioned, someone could have been born like Sal Castro, right, who belonged biologically to one generation, but kind of identified with another. And I thought about that with my own personal experience, and those, say, maybe born in these late 70s or the 80s that are kind of in between the Chicano generation and the, Latino generation, which really isn't really for, 20 years later, the millennials. So I guess the question was, could you talk a little about that? How people can be sort of be born, say, in the late 70s and 80s, and yet kind of even during that time identify maybe more as even Mexican American as opposed to Chicano? Can you just speak about that? What causes, do you think, maybe one person to be are all actually born in a later period, but maybe they identify with the previous generation or even a generation that's just emerging, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it, you know, has to deal with context, you know, where one is located and what the influences of, let's say, a previous historical political generation was, you know, and so maybe that that plays itself out in some respects. For example, in the Latino Generation book that I did, and of the 13 of my former students that I included in terms of their life stories, at least through college years, I don't recall that a single one identified as Chicano or Chicana. That's a term that for them is not particularly relevant, and so that's why, what's your background? Is your ethnic background? They'll say Mexican or Salvadoran, but at the same time, in talking with them, you get a sense that they are, you know, they do identify with, from like in a broader way, as Latinos, mm-hmm. and because they're in a way of sort of new technology and global migrations and greater diversity of distribution of people of Latin American background throughout the country, you know, they're in the rise of Spanish language media, which you know, addresses a broader pan-Latino audience. They have a larger sense of themselves as being Latino, mm-hmm. and not Chicano. And so, you know, each generation, you know, has to create its own sense of identity. Having said that, there are some within what I would call a Latino generation, because I know it because they're my class too, who do identify as Chicano. Mm-hmm. And maybe right. that has to do with their own particular background, maybe it has to do with their particular political orientation. So right. yeah, you can have these kind of crossovers consistently in terms of identity between generations. Having said that, as a historian, I have to, of course, take that into consideration, but also as myself, you know, but overarching, overall, right. is the right. way that we still kind of put a handle on new generation, what we would consider to be new generational period, to give them a kind of greater conceptualization. Of course, anytime you generalize or reach for generalization, of course, you're going to do injury to, you know, specific aspects of that experience, but right. you have to do it in order to just be able to understand historical change. Mm-hmm. Also wanted to mention, of course, you have figures who, I mentioned Sal Castro, who, you know, born in one biological generation, but really from a political perspective, part of the Chicano generation. But then you have Bird Corona, whom a story I also told.
Right, right.
And Bird, of course, really is positioned within the Mexican-American generation, not only biologically, but politically, mm-hmm. his activist generation. But then he transitions to the Chicano generation.
Right, right.
And all the way till he died in 2001, he was really part of that generation, and politics was transferred into that generation. And so you have those kinds of interesting crossovers. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. Yes, definitely. I appreciate your comments on that. And I wanted to speak now about the testimonial itself as a narrative form, because a number of your most recent publications have really focused on this form as a way to tell Chicano history. And so will you describe the testimonial for us? What are its kind of components, or what's its form, its purpose, and how does it differ from biography and, say, standard historical narrative?
Yeah, well, a testimonial comes out of the Latin American tradition that was developed in the 1960s, in which either scholars or journalists began to start interviewing a new leadership in Latin America, people that were struggling for social change and even engaged in revolutionary action, and to begin to tell their stories.
Mm-hmm.
Tell their stories in a way that not only would be of interest to an audience, but also that audience would reflect on those stories and possibly then act on the influence of those stories. And so that's the kind of testimonials that I've done, and we've mentioned Sal Castro, Bray Corona as two examples, and of course the Chicano Generation book that we'll also discuss today. But it is oral history. It's an oral history that it is not a biography, but it's done via oral history.
Right, right.
The subject, to use that term, the subject doesn't really write his or her own story. I, as a historian, interview them and write their story, and their story is mediated by my dialogue with them. Since I author the narrative, or at least co-author the narrative, by the very structure of the questions that I'm interested in, left to themselves, it's possible that they would have written slightly different autobiography. But the fact is that by choosing activists, most of these people don't have the time, don't have to do their own story. So it comes out of that Latin American tradition of a genre of writing intended to bring about social change. In the case of Latin America, perhaps even revolutionary change. And that's within that influence that I think I've approached these testimonials, which again are all oral histories, but they're not just as told to types of oral history, because I, as a historian, not only are doing the interviews, but doing the questioning, following up on the questioning, but I'm writing the whole thing. And in writing, I'm being creative also in order to put together, I try to keep as true to their language as possible, but I'm moving things around, I'm rearranging their narratives, because no one tells a narrative in a straight line.
Right.
So I have to rearrange it, reorder it. And I also have to write in a way that makes it appealing. So, among other things, I create dialogue, not that I just out of thin air. The dialogue is created out of my discussions and the responses of the people that I'm interviewing. From there, I structure a dialogue to make the narrative more interesting. So, some people think that oral history or doing these testimonials is basically what you're doing is just slapping the transcript.
Right. Yeah.
Tells me they don't know, they know nothing about doing oral history. And certainly not doing full length testimonials as I've done. You just simply don't do that. If you did that, it would just be a mess.
Right. So anyone that's read.
things together. But I think also, David, again, going back to the point of leadership and people making history, I'm interested in producing those kinds of narratives, these kinds of testimonials where, yeah, it's individuals, but it's individuals within a broader social context struggling for the, you know, for the empowerment of the Mexican American or Chicano communities and so forth. And I think to influence people to think about it, and maybe they'll finish that narrative by saying, well, maybe I need to pick up the struggle.
Right. Yeah. You mentioned that at the end, and both this book and in the Sal Castro book is that there is an underlying purpose to the testimonial that is in fact to engage its reader and motivate them, right? To motivate them to act. So there's a kind of a pedagogical, if you will, purpose that underlies it as well. You know, so the documenting of history, as you said, kind of in that oral history tradition. And I was going to mention that, you know, anyone that's read oral history transcript as it's been transcribed from a recording knows how messy those things are, right? And so indeed, there is a lot of skill and, insight that goes into crafting a coherent narrative, either weaving that into a standard narrative history or, you know, monograph type work or something like this, which is much more of that mix, as you're saying, between autobiography and oral history is and then even, you know, kind of like a social history that's involved too, because you weave all these things together. So,
yeah, autobiographies, by their very nature, tend to be much more individualistically oriented. A testimonial, as I mentioned, has a broader social context. And it is, I mentioned it, but it is a Freirean approach to narrative or producing narrative, that is to say, based on the views of Paulo Freire, the great Brazilian educator, where it develops the concept of observe, reflect, And I hope that my testimonials does that to the reader, that they observe the story, that they reflect on it, and then, as I said, maybe they'll say, maybe I've got to pick up the struggle and therefore go act on having read the narrative.
Right. And when you comment, the other thing I'm interested in is, you know, your last few books, if you will, have really kind of focused on this narrative form, testimonial in particular. Why is that? What's led you to, you know, essentially, you know, you published your first two really kind of standard historical works, a monograph and then a mixture of the, you know, sort of monograph and a survey, which was Mexican Americans of the leadership of that generation, if you will. And then you started transition into this direction. What led you to this form and this determined, because it seems you're very determined to continue to pursue this.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, as you know, I've done both archival driven books. I also have a book called Católicos, Resistance,
right,
which is archivally driven. I'm writing now a biography of Father Luis Olivares, who was involved in the sanctuary movement in LA, and that's a biography, not a testimonio. And so that's archivally driven. So I've done both, but I've done a lot of oral history. I've done a lot of oral history in my archivally driven books as well.
Mm-hmm.
But again, sometimes they began actually as biographies and then became testimonials.
Mm-hmm.
And because I felt that it might be more powerful to tell a story in the subject's own words, and so I concluded that maybe that was the kind of genre that I wanted to go into, telling people stories but in their own words. I thought that would make it more powerful than a biography where it's mediated by me, the historian.
Right.
And so some of it was practicality, a period of time where because of family situations, I knew I could not do as much archival work. And so doing oral history was in some ways more feasible. Not that it's less work, but,
right,
but it was more feasible. And so that drove me to do that. But after I did like the Bert Corona book, which was the first one, I just felt that doing it, was a very, could be a very empowering type of narrative. And so
Right. Then
as I went on to others, including the Sal Castro, I mean, to me, I had to tell Sal Castro's words in his own voice because his charisma, his great speaking ability, it would not have been done justice in a biography.
Right, right.
In his own words. And people have told me, you know, you've captured the way Sal spoke, and I feel good about that because that was my intent. Again, it's not just I'm just pasting the transcript onto the printed page.
Right.
I do a lot of work and moving things around and creating dialogue and so forth. But I kept true to as much as I could to Sal's way of speaking, you know,
mm-hmm.
And it's very powerful. So, that book had to be done in Sal's words.
Gotcha. Well, and then, so this book, moving on to the Chicano generation, this one in particular is about three key leaders within the Chicano movement in Los Angeles. So it's rooted in Los Angeles, and we focus on the experiences and narratives of Raul Ruiz, Gloria Arellanes, right, and Rosalio Munoz. Will you discuss why you chose to focus on Los Angeles? And then we'll use that to transition maybe into these three individuals in particular.
Well, you know, I'm not from L.A., but I've become an L.A. historian because I know a lot about L.A.
Mm-hmm.
And L.A., of course, was, in by some estimates, the political capital of the Chicano movement. Every manifestation, every struggle of the movement to a large degree occurred in Los Angeles. Not that it didn't occur in other places, but certainly L.A. was a major focus of the movement, and those movements influenced the movement in other locations as well. That's number one. Number two, the practicality. You know, from Santa Barbara to L.A., it's, 100 miles or less.
Right.
So my ability to go back and forth interviewing these three was part of that choice of Los Angeles. So the two together, I think, came together. But of course, LA was a major part of the Chicano movement. And this is a book that, as I mentioned in the introduction, has a long history to it. I actually started this project, over 20 years ago, and I first started by interviewing Raul Ruiz, and I thought I began the idea of maybe including Judy Baca in it, and
mm-hmm.
she was not as accessible. And I actually was going to do Jesus Treviño and the filmmaker, and I did lots of interviews with Jesus, but then I guess Jesus maybe thought, maybe it'll be too long before Mario Garcia gets his book out. So he went on his own and wrote his own autobiography.
Mm.
That was published by the book. So I said, well, that's great, Jesus. I'm glad you got your story out. Obviously I couldn't include his story in my project. So it took a number of years. And, of course, I was doing other projects that were a little bit ahead of this particular project. But I always kept doing the interviews and finally focused on, besides Raul Ruiz, and the reason I chose Raul, of course, because Raul was the Renaissance man of the Chicano movement. He was in so many different activities. He was involved in the student movement. He was involved in the walkouts. He was involved in La Raza in the Party and Católicos con la Raza, in the anti-war movement. And, of course, he edited and published La Raza magazine, which was the most influential Chicano movement publication in Los Angeles and elsewhere also. Raul was a natural to do.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosario Munoz was also a natural because, of course, he was the key leader of the major Chicano anti-Vietnam War movement that culminated in August 29, 1971, and 30,000 mostly Chicano protests against the war in East LA.
Right.
The largest protest organized during the movement, and was the largest anti-war protest by any minority group. And so Rosalia was a natural too. And eventually I focused on Gloria Arianez. In a way, she was a natural, too. Gloria, who's less well-known in the movement, but hopefully will be better known as a result of the book, has a very powerful story to tell. She was the only so-called minister of the Brown Berets in Los Angeles. And, of course, the Brown Berets originated in L.A., and that was considered the national chapter. Many, many other Brown Beret chapters spread throughout the Southwest and beyond the Southwest. But the L.A. was the national chapter with its Prime Minister David Sanchez and the Minister of Defense and the Minister of that and the Minister of that. But Gloria was part of the initial cohort of women who joined the Brown Berets in the late 60s, and she rose to become the only female minister of the Brown Berets, Minister of Education. And so she has a very powerful story to tell within a very important Chicano movement organization that was considered perhaps the most radical or one of the most militant of the Chicano movement groups. And what you get out of Gloria's story is that, yes, of course, it was not the most radical, and you had a lot of guys in it, but in many ways it was the women who held the Brown Berets together. It was the women who did the hard work of the Brown Berets. I mean, they published, Gloria was basically the editor, although David Sanchez was given the credit as editor, but they published their newspaper. She was the one, she and the women are the one that put it together. But then also, she tells her story of working and putting together the Brown Beret Free Clinic in East L.A., El Barrio Free Clinic. And she and the women were the bedrock of that free clinic, and they operated for a year and a half, and they did tremendous service to the community in East L.A. by providing medical services through the volunteer efforts of doctors and nurses. But it was the women and Gloria who put it all together and did these services. And to me, in looking at the history of the Brown Berets in L.A., that free clinic was probably the greatest contribution that the Brown Berets did in its history with respect to the Chicano movement, because it reached people in a way that none of the other efforts of the Brown Berets could people get reached. I mean, they treated hundreds, if not thousands, of people in that clinic. Yeah, Gloria held it together, but, you know, she eventually, in the first cohort of women, left because of the sexism by the guys in the berets, and the book goes into some of those encounters and some of those conflicts, including the threat of rape. So it's a very, very powerful story, and the story that needs to be told. And she mentions that very few of the other women in the initial cohort of the brown berets, were very reluctant to tell their story. So she said, I'm telling my story, but I'm telling my story for them as well.
Mm-hmm.
I will encourage them to begin to tell their stories. And so she's a tremendous person and very powerful, and someone who suffered a lot as a result of the movement. And, well, they all did. Their lives were changed dramatically by the movement. And what I mentioned in my introduction is that they all remain committed people in one way or another. They never betrayed their ideals that they developed during the movement, the struggle for social justice and community empowerment and ethnic integrity and so forth. I think they always stayed committed. They never will look back and said, oh, well, those were just my fanciful youth days, and now, you know, I'm much more established. And so, no, they've always been committed to the struggle.
Right. And what intrigues me is, again, we're the narrative, one of the narrative themes that flows throughout the book is this focus on leadership. And what I started thinking about as I was reading through, you know, these three different narratives of these three people and their exceptional lives, were that, you know, they come from such diverse backgrounds, and the Chicano movement itself was so many things, right, to so many different people. You've begun to mention a number of the different components of the movement. You know, there is the student, you know, component to the organization, both at the high school level, the blowouts, the walkouts. You know, then you had the university component, fighting for, you know, representation and the development of Chicano studies curriculum and programs and spaces on campus. You had the anti-war movement, the brown berets, and many other things. And so considering that and considering the very diverse backgrounds of these three, what is it that we learn about leadership by studying their lives? Because I think that sometimes I think when we hear the term leadership, we think elite, right? We think that these, you know, someone was either, you know, a lot of times it's associated with people that were born into either some type of privilege or were predisposed somehow, predestined maybe, to use a very lofty term, in some way to a leadership role. But certainly by studying their lives, at least initially, there's nothing perhaps from their initial very, like, say, childhood or birth, you know, they weren't born to people that necessarily were you would necessarily identify them as they're destined or born to be a leader, but yet you identify commonalities in their lives. And so we discussed that. What is it that we learn about how leadership, or how people develop into leaders, or how they you know, become activists? What are the components that you found that led them to these trajectories, these tracks?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And, you know, that's what I suggest, of course, that there's a process of becoming a leader. You're not born a leader.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking of your gene, but I think it has to do with socialization. And that socialization, as I suggest in the book, begins even before they become political activists.
Mm-hmm.
So I look at their family lives, and that's why I asked them to first begin to discuss their childhood memories, their family memories, and so forth. And what you draw from that is that each one of them, you know, had certain influences in their early upbringing that began to influence them to, you know, assert themselves, to be proud of themselves, to not accept being put down for being Mexican, so forth and so on. And even though all three have very distinct family backgrounds, I think there is something that in part connects them. And it doesn't have to be just family socialization. It can be socialization in the school. That comes through in the story, Ariana's story. although her father was always telling her, you're a Chicano, you're a Chicano.
Right, I noticed that.
And so that's something that was early ingrained in her, and she didn't fully understand that and so forth. But I think in school, then, she was, there was lots of tension between the whites and the Mexican-Americans in her high school in El Monte High School. And then there was one teacher who began to try to bridge the gap, and he began to help the Chicanos organize amongst themselves. And he chose Gloria to be one of two representatives to the first Chicano youth leadership conferences that Fidel Castro was involved in, going back to the early 60s. And so that helped to create her sense of leadership. I think the other two, even more directly within the family, I think Monroe's family, a sense of, standing up for his rights and so forth, through his mother, his mother sending him to Catholic school to kind of, make sure that he got as good an education as possible. And I think Raul also was just, I don't want to do a genetic analysis, but I mean, he was always a kind of a babbler, he was always kind of a rebel type.
Mm-hmm.
And Rosario, of course, had a strong parental influence, strong religious influence. And his father, both his parents were well educated, they were college educated. His father went on to get a PhD in education from USC, so he had that in his background, So his family socialization was one of, community leadership and so forth. And of course, that began to emerge very early on when he runs for in UCLA and becomes elected as student body president.
Right.
Mm-hmm. To be involved in those movements. So I think, I guess what I'm suggesting is that leadership is a result of socialization already in your early childhood and your teenage years and early adult years, and then in a particular context that emerges in terms of asserting yourself to be part of a struggle and to be part of a leadership of that struggle. Yes, I know that. I mean, there's this sense that sometimes leadership, equals elitism, often said by people who themselves want to be leaders, but misunderstand the. The fact of the matter is, as I said earlier, all movements, social, political movements, they have leadership, and of course, you want some of that leadership, and some of that leadership is grassroots leadership.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That was when the farm worker struggle, when Bert Corona began to organize the undocumented, he tried to develop leadership out of the undocumented immigrants themselves. And it's not like Raul and Gloria and Rosalio came from these blue-blooded families.
Mm-hmm.
These are not Kennedys, Rockefellers, these that are born to leadership. These are
right.
Chicanos, working class, lower middle class, are also facing a lot of racial and ethnic discrimination and so forth and so on. So they're not, part of some kind of separate elitist families and so forth. No, they're people who, again, as I mentioned, have developed conviction, developed a sense of values of trying to achieve social justice. And they also have a very important characteristic that they have discipline and they have persistence. They understood what Bert Corona often told the activists of the Chicano movement. He said, if you're going to be involved in struggle, you have to realize that struggle is going to take a long time.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen overnight, and so forth and so on. Some understood that, like these three that I write about, others less so, and, change didn't happen in a short period of time, an academic year or whatever. Then
mm-hmm.
they said, well, I guess things don't change, and they dropped out. But so I admire Raul's and Gloria's and Rosalio's, their sense of persistence, their sense of dedication for the long haul.
Right, and on that persistence and dedication, that longer perspective that they had, you label this that they had a collectively a type of militant pragmatism, right? There's a revolutionary aspect to Chicano ideology, and And however, that, I think that's mostly what people focus on. I think that has to do a lot with why or why not people identify even today, perhaps even youth millennials and whatnot, as Chicano, because it's very politically charged and it's associated with, right, third world revolutionary struggles, you know, the communism, Marxism, et cetera. Yet again, you label these three as pragmatists, militant pragmatists. Will you explain that a bit?
Well, you know, there was a lot of ideological influences on the movement, the concept of Aztlan, the lost homeland of the Chicanos in the Southwest, and a lot, some of that was more romanticized, perhaps, and so forth. And it's not that they weren't influenced by Chicano nationalism, what we'll just call cultural nationalism, but they also understood, these three, that struggles had to be practical, had to be pragmatic, they had to be at the grassroots. Ideology could only take you so far. You had the problems in the schools, like in the blowouts. You had a lack of political representation, hence a lot of us in the party. You had young people, young boys, young men who were being inordinately drafted into the military to go fight an unnecessary war in Vietnam. How to stop it? Hence Rosalio Munoz and the Chicano anti-war movement and so forth. And how to help people in the community that needed things like health care. Hence Gloria and the Rambouray Free Clinic. And so, in that sense, they are pragmatic, but they're driven by a militant ethos of bringing about an empowerment to the community, challenging the status quo, challenging the way things are. So, in that sense, they're militant.
Right.
But they express that militancy in very pragmatic ways, and that's what I came to it. Be impressed by and admire the work of these three, that they were not just spouting ideologies and revolutionary slogans and so forth and so on. They saw what needed to be done to try to bring about concrete change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's where their pragmatism is involved. And so I think that's probably true for a lot of other movement activists, you know, and I think the more we examine the Chicano movement and other communities and so forth, many of these struggles have the larger kind of ideological coloration, but in the end, you have to struggle against, you know, basic issues and basic needs. And so I think mm-hmm. we learn more and more about the movement, especially in different locations, I think we see that those kind of struggles take place. Like the two conferences that I've had, as you know, in the Chicano movement,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the papers that presented show those kind of very practical struggles in different communities. In San Antonio, the labor movement, the Chicano in the labor movement, they were influenced by the movement, and then that just helped propel them even more in terms of trying to get contracts and higher wages and so forth. So that's, you see that kind of pragmatism being exhibited there also.
Right. And, you know, that comment just leads me directly to my next question. And I know we need to wrap up, but I would definitely want you to, you know, comment on where you see movement on, I mean, sorry, the development and progress of, or direction, I think is a better word, the direction of the scholarship on the Chicano movement headed. As you mentioned, you organized two, so far, it's now an annual conference that's on the movement. And then, of course, you've published now a number of works that address with key figures within the movement. And so you're very close and, you know, be able to analyze, you know, what you've seen, say, you know, over the last, you know, 10 years or decade or so, is really scholarship on the movement has begun to flower and really develop. So where else do you see it going, that is the scholarship on the movement?
Well, what I'm seeing, I see the scholarship developing, and I see it presented at the two conferences that I've organized here at UC Santa Barbara. the third, which is coming up in February 2027, which is now called the Sal Castro Memorial Conference on the Emerging Historiography of the Chicano Movement. I see diversity. I think that's first and foremost how people are interpreting the movement in very diverse ways,
mm-hmm.
in terms of diverse actors, if you will, bringing in a greater diverse group of activists that we might have been less aware of. Like I mentioned, the labor movement in L.A. that identified with the movement. We had a couple paper at the first conference. So also the labor movement up in Sacramento, but also identifying with the movement and so forth. The greater role, exploring the role of women in the movement and so forth. And so the diversity in terms of who the political actors were, diversity in terms of locations, of how the movement manifested itself in a variety of locations, you know, not just necessarily the big cities like L.A. or San Antonio, but in smaller communities, Oxnard, and I mentioned, you know, Sacramento. People are doing the role of the movement in South Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of diversity. And but I think driven by an appreciation of the historical importance of the Chicano movement, it is, in effect, a revisionist perspective. And by that I mean is that the movement into the 80s and 90s, and even to the first decade of this century, was getting a bad rap, so I can use that term, by other Chicano studies scholars. We often, and still do, ask these litmus tests of the movement, and if they failed at this litmus test, the suggestion is the movement was not important.
Mm-hmm.
That's largely driven by issues of gender and sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
So if the question is, how was the movement with respect to the role of women, gender, and if it's either no or if it wasn't as good as it should be, well, then obviously the movement wasn't all that important. How did the movement deal with gays, lesbians, etc.? Well, the movement didn't really deal a lot with that. Well, then I guess the movement wasn't altogether that great. It's the wrong questions. Historians don't ask these kind of litmus tests of history. It's a misreading of history.
Mm-hmm.
It's a presentist of kind of voicing onto history your own contemporary perspectives and views. Obviously, the past and present are intertwined. You can sometimes force history in a very, in a way that really doesn't fully understand what was going on in that past period. And that's what I mean by revision, that this kind of almost grading the Chicano movement from a gender and sexuality perspective that we've seen in the last 20, 30 years, this new group of scholars, many of them young scholars now, graduate students, are coming back and saying, no, we're not going to ask that litmus test. Yes, we're going to explore issues of gender and sexuality.
Right, right.
But at the same time, understand how important the Chicano movement was.
Right, right.
All of us, in one form or another, are in a sort of debt to the movement. I mean, when you think about it, the movement opened up so many opportunities that people of Mexico
certainly.
Had never had. Where did this come from? Like, we talk about contemporary Latino political power. What's the roots of that? Where did it come from?
Mm-hmm.
What can make the argument that the Chicano movement helped to create that? Because it, for the first time, I mentioned in my introduction, it made Chicanos and by extension other Latinos into national political actors.
Right.
Even into the 70s. So I think what I'm very excited about is a lot of these new studies are generated by people, especially younger scholars, who are embracing the movement as a very important historical movement. That doesn't mean that they're not critical.
Exactly.
Critical studies, but they're engaged studies,
mm-hmm.
and they're not asking these false litmus tests. So I think diversity and with this new appreciation of the movement. I'm very excited about it. In our February conference coming up, February 26th, 27th, it'll be at least 25 presentations, and they're all, different subjects and themes. And so it is really, I mean, there's something now that we can call Chicano movement studies.
Right.
And able to highlight that at these El Paso conferences. So whatever work I've done recently on the Chicano movement is you know, is part of that, is to add to that and to encourage you to others. Like these three stories that I tell in the Chicano generation, these are all three possible opportunities for, you know, younger enterprising historians to say, well, okay, I'm going to do a full biography of Raul Ruiz, or a full biography of Gloria Arias, or a full biography of Rosalía Murillo, and they're deserving of that. So what I've done is laid the foundation for those future biographies, because they can draw from my oral histories and the testimonials and then build on them by going into more archival research or more oral histories around the people that work with these three and so forth. So hopefully that will occur.
Great. Right. I totally agree. Thank you for that comment. And, you know, I know you're pressed for time. I did want to give you the opportunity to mention anything else that is, as we wrap up, that you're currently working on, that's a, you know, a project you have that's developing that you'd like our audience to hear about.
Uh-huh. Well, I mentioned that my current, my current project that I've been working on actually for a number of years is a biography, not an oral history or a testimonial, but a biography of Father Luis Olivares, who in the 1980s became best known because he was the heart and soul of the sanctuary movement in Los Angeles, out of his parish, La Placita Church, in downtown Los Angeles. And he, in 1985, declared his church a sanctuary for the Central American refugees that were coming as a result of the wars in El Salvador and Guatemala. And then 2 years later did what no other sanctuary movement had done. He declared sanctuary of La Placita for undocumented Mexican immigrants.
Uh-huh.
And
right.
In between, you know, he worked in terms of trying to end the U.S. involvement in Central America by supporting right-wing governments and death squads and so forth. And but I tell the whole story from childhood in San Antonio to his years in the seminary, learning to become a Claretian priest, to becoming a top official of his order, but then in 1975, by his own admission, undergoing a conversion when he meets Cesar Chavez and he begins to work with the farm workers. And then in the later 70s, out of his parish, he goes to become a parish priest in East L.A. at La Soledad. And there he becomes a key leader of an organization referred to as UNO, United Neighborhoods Organization. And he learns how his skills as an organizer and strategies. And then in 1981, when he transfers to La Placita Church, it's at the time that the refugees are coming, and the 80s, of course, a big wave of undocumented immigrants, and he applies what he's learned earlier in his new converted attitude to progressivism and liberation theology to embrace and to support you know, the poor and the oppressed, in this case the refugees and the undocumented. And he continues that till the end of his life. He died in 1993. And I obviously never had a chance to interview him because I did not become interested in his life until later. I knew of him, but at the time that he died, I wasn't working on his biography. But it's a remarkable life. And it's not only in terms of, again, expression of a new kind of leadership, in this case, rigid, religious, spiritual leadership that we also need to examine. But it's, what he was involved in is also looking at faith-based movements.
Mm-hmm.
And out of the La Placita Church and earlier with UNO, you have these faith-based movements that were very important, that in the case of UNO, accomplished very practical reforms that in the East L.A. community. And then, of course, in the 80s, it's Olivares' work with the refugees and the undocumented to deal with people who were being victimized and who had no rights, really, in this country, and to begin to talk about immigrant rights. And but it was through a faith-based movement that's developed. So there's a lot of different facets to explore in Olivares' life, but he was a very charismatic and just a totally committed leader, but a leader working within within the Catholic Church in his case. And so that's another question of leadership that we need to also explore if one is interested in the role of leadership in Chicano history.
Certainly. Definitely. Thank you for sharing that with us. Well, Mario, I really appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedule to discuss the Chicano generation on New Books in Latino Studies. And just best of luck in the rest of your studies. And hopefully we'll look forward to speaking with you again.
Thank you so much, Dave. I really appreciate it. And good luck on your work.
Thank you. Thank you for tuning in to New Books in Latino Studies. I'm David James Gonzalez, the host of the channel, and I hope you've enjoyed my conversation today with Mario T. Garcia, author of The Chicano Generation, Testimonials of the Movement, published by the University of California Press in 2015. If you'd like to reach us at New Books in Latino Studies, you may email us at newbooksinlatinostudies@gmail.com or connect with us on Facebook or Twitter. If you would like to learn more about Dr. Garcia's work, we encourage you to purchase The Chicano Generation on Amazon by following the link to it on our New Books in Latino Studies page. Thanks again.